The Forest of John's always had a very strong response to the accusation that Buddhism teaches people to be lazy. The idea that we should be content with everything. What we need is a paradigm shift in our minds, realizing that there's nobody here doing anything. That somehow should solve the problem. We should be content with whatever mind states come up, and not think that we have to do anything about them. John Fuang would quote the passage where the Buddha says, it's through effort that suffering is overcome. And John Suat would point out the fact that the Buddhist teachings on how to find happiness in this lifetime start with initiative. In other words, rolling up your sleeves, if you have sleeves, and plunging right in to do what needs to be done. It's part of a longer list of the things that lead to happiness in this lifetime. You start with initiative. You should realize that if you're going to gain any wealth in this lifetime, get any security in this lifetime, you've got to do work. You've got to be willing to sacrifice present comfort for future well-being. Like the story of the ant and the grasshopper. The grasshopper singing away in the summer. And the ant's very busy finding food, storing food. And the grasshopper says, why are you working so hard? It's so nice outside. Enjoy the warmth of the summer. And the ant says, no, I have to prepare for the winter. Of course, when the winter comes, the grasshopper dies, but the ant is secure. That's the attitude that the Forest of Johns would hold. Many of them came from poor families, and they had a very strong sense that they needed to do something to get out of that poverty. It wasn't going to happen on its own. So they did what had to be done. That's the meaning of the phrase, practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma, that they derive from that phrase. The canon says it's referring to the fact that you practice for the sake of dispassion. But for the Forest of Johns, it meant that whatever is required, you do it. If they had ever heard of that saying from the third Chan patriarch, the great way is not hard for those with no preferences, they would have understood what it meant. Of course you prefer wealth over poverty. Of course you prefer gaining the freedom from suffering. But whatever you have to do to get there, you're not going to let your preferences get in the way. You say, well, I don't like doing that, or that sounds too hard for me or too harsh for me. You do what needs to be done. As long as your efforts are in line with right effort, right livelihood, and all the other right factors of the path, then really devoting yourself to that is not greed. It's initiative, energy. That's the first factor for happiness. The second is that whatever you've gained, you look after it. You maintain your wealth well. Whatever you have, you don't just treat it casually. There was one time when I almost dropped a cup, and John Fuang asked me, what would you have done if the cup had actually dropped? I said, oh, we can get a new one. I got a very strong, stern lecture about that. If something is breakable, you hold on tight. You worked hard to gain these things, and you don't have to add more work to yourself by having to replace them. So you maintain your belongings, look after them well, take care of them. The third principle, keeping your spending in line with what you've earned. Not too frugal, and certainly not spendthrift. You might be surprised that the Buddhists warn against being too frugal. But if you're stingy, like the people who make money, but are afraid to spend it at all, get no enjoyment out of it, they're going to look down on people who do enjoy their wealth. And the concept of mudita, being happy for the happiness of others, just doesn't occur, doesn't get developed. If you don't allow yourself to be happy, you don't want anybody else to either. So you gain some joy from your wealth, but you don't squander it. And finally, the fourth principle is having admirable friends. but not only having admirable friends, but engaging in admirable friendship. Which means that if they have good qualities, the Buddha gives a list. Conviction, virtue, generosity, discernment. You try to emulate those qualities. You actually ask them, how do you do this? If you have trouble being generous, ask people who are generous, how do you do this? What is your way of thinking that allows you to be generous? If you have trouble sticking with the precepts, ask people who can stick with the precepts, how do you go about this? You do this so you can be an admirable friend for yourself, because these are the qualities, the Buddha said, that lead beyond happiness in this lifetime and go into the next lifetime. You can actually apply these qualities to your meditation. You want to make an effort. You want to have initiative. As John Fuang said, you know, they had 4-hour meditation sessions every evening with the Chun Li. The sessions lasted from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Even after the sessions were over, he didn't just go back and rest in his hut. He would go back and meditate some more. He took the 4 hours as an absolute minimum. I remember talking to a professional athlete one time. And he talked about the desire to really excel. That would be the difference between a lot of people in his sport. There were those who were just happy they were playing on the professional level. But then there were those who really wanted to excel. And some people say, well, it's going to involve a sense of ego. It's going to involve a sense of me or mine doing the work. Well, the Buddha encourages that. When he teaches Rahula about how to learn from his actions, the questions you ask are, before you do something, this action that I want to do, while you're doing this action I am doing, when the action is done, this action that I have done. The I is important there. It's a sign of your willingness to take responsibility for your actions. That's not just for beginning levels. There's a passage on the development of mindfulness as a governing principle, which you decide, any training that I haven't mastered yet, I will master that training. And once I've mastered it, I will protect it with discernment. Whatever rudiments of the holy life I have yet to master, I will master them. When I've mastered them, I will protect them with discernment. Whatever things I haven't yet scrutinized with discernment, I will scrutinize them, and then I will protect my understanding. Whatever release I've found, if I haven't found it yet, I will do it. Once I found it, I will protect it. Again, I will, I will, I will. The Buddha doesn't discourage that, a sense of I doing the practice. There are some people who say that once you have an I am or I am doing this in your mind, then you've developed a wrong view. You're off the path. But then who's going to do the path? It doesn't do itself. You can expect the universe to come in and do it for you. You've got to be responsible. That's the attitude you have. I'm sitting down here, I'm going to meditate. My mind wanders off, I'm going to bring it back. Wanders off again, I'm going to bring it back again. I'm not going to give in. Because after all, you're fighting not with people outside here. You're fighting with other members of your committee or other members of the crowd you have in the mind. You have to have a clear sense of which of the many I's and me's in there you're going to side with. You want to side with the ones who look for your long-term welfare and happiness. In fact, that's how discernment begins. You identify with what, when I do it, will lead to my long-term welfare and happiness. Okay, I'm going to do the things that need to be done. That's the I in your committee that you want to identify with. Now, once you have attained concentration, okay, you protect it. You don't throw it away. Mind settles down. The bell rings, you don't just drop it. You try to hold it carefully as you get up, as you bow down. Maintain it as best you can. This habit that some of us have of going back and spending a good half hour chatting after the evening meditation, it's a bad habit. Each person should go back and protect them, whatever concentration they've had. That's the second principle. Third principle, you enjoy your meditation, but don't just wallow in it. There's going to be a sense of well-being from the concentration. And it's an important part of the concentration. After all, concentration is food for the other elements of the path. It's what feeds the soldiers of right effort, feeds the gatekeeper of mindfulness. So gain some enjoyment, but don't just wallow in the pleasure. If you wallow in the pleasure, you leave the breath, fall into delusion concentration. To have a sense of spending your pleasure in the most fruitful way. And then finally, listen to the voices inside, listen to the voices outside that advise you how to develop your conviction even further, how to develop your virtue, your generosity, and especially your discernment even further. Those are your friends. So these principles, even though they're mainly aimed at lay people looking for work, looking for a good livelihood, they're also good for your livelihood as a meditator. Initiative, protecting what you've got, spending it wisely, enjoying your wealth wisely, and developing admirable friendship. Whatever desires you have in this direction, tell yourself, I will pursue those desires, because they're good desires. Not all desires bad. There's the desire of right effort, the desire of right resolve. Once you've attained these qualities, do your best to protect them. Don't throw them away. That's how you employ that principle. Mindfulness is a governing principle. It applies both inside and out.